From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Pulse. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Mike and Scott. The house call, it's an image straight out of the old Marcus Welby TV show.
I used to go around and see people on my bicycle. And I had a dog, and I used to take my dog sometimes too.
The doctor-patient relationship often cut both ways.
So I go and examine her, and sure enough, I thought she was in heart failure. And then when it was all over, they said, Dr. Warren, we want you to sit now. We're going to give you a Lebanese lunch.
Today's house call is futuristic.
You can pretty much be a walking emergency room with equipment you carry in your pockets.
While still offering a dose of old-fashioned comfort.
I don't have to worry about finding two people to take the wheelchair, get them out the car once we get to the doctor's office.
Also, space travel. It's not just for astronauts anymore. And the latest on Pfizer's attempt to take over AstraZeneca. First, the news. There's something comforting about having a doctor visit you when you're ill.
It's Dr. Kanosian.
Hello.
Hi. How are you? Hi, Mr. Singleton.
The house call. Its reputation is low tech, but no more.
Pulse oximeter, glucometer, blood analyzer, pocket ultrasound devices. You can pretty much be a walking emergency room with equipment you carry in your pockets.
Could house calls be making a comeback? This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, filling in for Mike and Scott. The Pulse hops on electric trains and samples tap water to really understand the latest research and science.
Into the surgery, their urine turned Kelly Green.
There's about 2 to 3 million people in the United States known to be living with epilepsy.
Itchy eyes, sneezing, runny nose.
Often it runs in families.
Circuit boards using soybeans and chicken feathers.
They're nice and shiny, kind of pearly white.
Other people approaching them and commenting on how they look or telling them to.
I generally dislike buzzwords.
You don't use honey on your face?
It was felt to be related to hysteria.
They didn't want to accept the fact that you were on the same level.
On today's show, is gluten sensitivity fact or fiction? We talked to a gastroenterologist from Jefferson University Hospital to find out what one recent study really means. Also, opening up space travel to the public for a steep price. But first up, we take a stroll down memory lane. Long ago, doctors visited the sick instead of the other way around. In our modern era of crowded waiting rooms, it's hard to believe there was ever another way. Pulse contributor and Drexel med student Avir Mitra decided to track down a physician who practiced during the era of the house call, and that search brought him all the way to a nursing home in Easton, Pennsylvania.
Okay, my name is Jonathan Warren, and I'm a retired internist living with his family in Easton.
Today I'm with Dr. Warren as he takes a break from volunteering at a busy nursing home.
So did you ever, when you were younger, did you ever used to make house calls, go to a patient's house?
Oh, yes. Yes, I used to make house calls. I used to go around and see people on my bicycle. And I had a dog, and I used to take my dog sometimes, too.
I asked Dr. Warren to describe his first house call.
I went to the woman's house. She had two daughters. They were both there. They said that she's eating very poorly and she's lost weight. Okay. So I go and examine her, and sure enough, I thought she was in heart failure. I had her lie down in bed, and I looked at her neck veins, and I looked at the swelling of her legs. And then when it was all over, they really appreciated just the fact that I went to the house. They said, Dr. Warren, we want you to sit now. We're going to give you a Lebanese lunch. And it was wonderful. That was the dream of the whole day.
Believe it or not, these type of interactions with your doctor used to be the norm. In 1930, 40% of physician visits were house calls. But by 1980, that number had dropped to 1%.
People liked it. It was interesting. And you get a sense about what their lives were like and what their homes were like.
If a patient had a rash and you saw bed bugs, well, there was your answer. If they offered you dinner, you might taste too much salt. Seeing the patient at home put their disease in the context of their environment, while seeing a patient in an office or hospital in some ways is like seeing a fish out of water.
At one point in time, it was really fun. Medicine was really fun. It's not as much fun anymore.
But as the power of modern medicine, the x-rays, the blood tests, the surgical procedures, all of it, grew exponentially, it only made sense to abandon the house call model in favor of a more efficient hospital-based system. After all, that's where the doctors actually had the tools to do things. But that special intimacy between doctor and patient was gone. Forever. Or maybe not. Recently, two medical students from Temple University won third place in a national competition sponsored by the Association of Medical Colleges, in which contestants were asked to make a video that would envision the medical innovations of tomorrow. Instead of imagining spaceships and alien medicine, they had an interesting vision. Here's Aaron Hickey.
Okay. So we were asked to make a video about the future of academic medicine. And one of the conversations we had in our meeting was, how can we be unique? How can we think outside the box?
So they imagined a future with house calls.
So we developed this house call video.
This is Nick Osavala, the other medical student.
And the way it worked was that a medical student and a resident sort of showed up at a patient's house.
She opens the door. She's excited to see them. She has had this relationship with them for a long time, and she trusts them. So they walk in. How are you? They sit down.
Good morning, Ms. Perez. Nice to see you.
They start talking about how she's feeling, you know, what's changed in her health since the last visit.
And then at that point, they beam in holographically an attending physician from the main university hospital.
From here, the team uses futuristic technology to read her blood work and send the data back to the hospital. The attending advises them remotely.
And then at that point, they just sort of beam them back out again, and the medical student and the resident sort of, you know, shook hands with the patient, and we're on their way to the next house.
Your idea about the future, it's kind of retro in a way.
Sure. But we wanted to bring the house call back because we thought it might be the best way to sort of tie in the technological advances in the next 20 and 30 years, but maintain that level of personal care that I think is the reason why we all decided to get into this in the first place.
But for now, their vision is just that, a vision. Yet maybe if we look closely, we can see the signs of a shift starting to take place. As the population gets older and frailer, and as hospital infection rates go up, there's a new incentive to bring healthcare back to the home. And believe it or not, house calls are happening right now in Philadelphia.
It's Dr. Kanosian.
This is Bruce Kanosian. He's a primary care doctor and associate professor of medicine at Penn. And he makes house calls.
Hi, how are you? Hi, Mr. Singleton.
Dr. Kanosian let me tag along today as we visit James Singleton, a retired Army veteran who lives in West Philly. Last year, James had a stroke with multiple medical complications that left him bedbound. But thanks to a year of house calls from a multidisciplinary team, he's been steadily improving.
So what are you putting on this now?
We got right to business by asking James how he was feeling, getting vitals, and changing bandages. But the conversation soon veered into directions no regular office visit would ever take. We discussed the new ramp we saw on his porch. And when James complained of constipation, we took a look in his fridge and noticed a lot of dairy.
How would you feel with trying lactose-free ice cream and milk for a week?
All right. No problem. Okay.
We looked in his medicine cabinet.
You can see what medicines they have. You can also see all the other medicines that they have that they didn't bring in that you didn't know about.
Then Dr. Kanosian broke out his medicine bag, and what came out was anything but retro.
Pulse oximeter, glucometer. There are pocket ultrasound devices that, because of smart software, can double as an echocardiogram, as an abdominal ultrasound, as a Doppler looking for a blood clot in the leg. There's a blood analyzer.
Maybe the student's video wasn't pure science fiction after all.
You can pretty much be a walking emergency room with equipment you carry in your pockets.
Dr. Kanosian has James hold an iPhone, which has a case with metal leads on it. He opens an EKG app.
Yeah, blinking.
And it's measuring your heart.
Yeah.
So Mr. Singleton has a conduction problem. He has a right bundle branch block.
So we can see that all just by having his fingers on this iPhone.
Mm-hmm. Gives you a rhythm strip.
What do you think about that?
Amazed.
So here, you know, before I spoke to you, I thought this was something that was dying out.
No, there's actually a large demonstration in another part of the Affordable Care Act called Independence at Home that's ongoing.
Independence at Home is a little-known three-year experiment, or demo, written into the Affordable Care Act. Its purpose is to beta test the house call as a way to deal with the 10% of Medicare patients who account for two-thirds of Medicare's expenditures. The theory is that for these high-cost patients, house calls might actually be more efficient, more effective, and ultimately cheaper.
Now it's in its second year of a three-year demo.
And the early results are promising.
That it actually saved the Medicaid program about 25%. People live longer, and almost all of that life was spent out of nursing homes. Yeah, so it was one of those that saves money and gives people a higher quality of life, so it's sort of a general win-win.
In fact, 10 years of data from Kenosian's team were a big part of getting Independence at Home into the Affordable Care Act in the first place. It was their results with VA patients like James Singleton that convinced senators that a demo was warranted. Right now, the demo is limited to 10,000 patients. If, after 3 years, the results show overall savings for Medicare, that cap could be removed.
Well, no, I think that Independence Home is going to radically transform how healthcare gets delivered and gets paid for in this country. There's probably 1.5 million Medicare beneficiaries that are eligible for Independence at Home.
In other words, the house call might be coming back in a big way.
Well, no, I mean, this is like the natural place to do this. No, when Mr. Singleton was first home, it would have been really difficult getting them out of the house. Mm-hmm. See how he's walking now? He was stuck in the bed.
Here's Singleton's daughter.
I don't have to worry about finding two people to, you know, take the wheelchair down the steps, try to get it in the car, and get him in the car and get him out the car once we get to the doctor's office. It's a smoother process.
And that, do you think that results in him getting better care or just more convenient?
Absolutely. Better care. It's better for people in his situation.
So I asked James.
I like this better. Beautiful. I love it. If it's hot outside, I can stay right in with the air conditioning. If it's cold, I can stay in with the heat. Yeah. Enjoy every bit of it.
For The Pulse, I'm Avir Mitra.
The pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca, which has a strong footprint in Delaware, has fended off Pfizer's takeover attempt. Pfizer, based in New York, officially announced Monday it will not pursue the deal. However, as The Pulse's Alana Gordon tells us, both companies face uncertain futures.
AstraZeneca is a British company, but its U.S. headquarters are based right here, standing here, right off of Highway 202 in Wilmington, Delaware. Across the street, the campus, it's a mixture of 3, 4, 5-story brick buildings all strung together. Looks kind of like a college campus. You might know the company for things like Crestor, its cholesterol drug. The company employs about 2,500 people in Delaware.
So it's a big impact. They have a great history in the state.
Alan Levin is director of Delaware's Economic Development Office. He says AstraZeneca is important to the region. But a few months ago, Pfizer, based in New York, announced it wanted to take over the company. It sparked worries in Delaware and the UK.
We want them to stay here. We want them to be the survivor in this deal.
Some have been concerned about Pfizer's motives for a merger, that they're rooted in cutting costs and avoiding corporate taxes in the U.S. But Pfizer's deadline to move forward with an offer expired Monday under British rules. Eric Gordon is a business professor at the University of Michigan. He's not convinced the deal is totally dead, based on how Pfizer couched its announcement that it wouldn't pursue the bid.
They said that they thought the price they offered was a good full price, given the information they had. That's the kind of language you say that leaves the door open to make a higher offer if you get different information. So I think Pfizer is keeping its options open.
Gordon says the company will now have to wait 6 months if it wants to initiate another offer. In 3 months, AstraZeneca can invite Pfizer back to the table if it so chooses. George Chrysanthis is with the Fox School of Business in Philadelphia.
Pfizer's bid is really, I think, an epitome of what's going on in the industry.
Chrysanthis, who used to work at AstraZeneca, says major changes across the sector have been driving whole waves of mergers and downsizing. Around this region, Pfizer previously took over Wyeth. AstraZeneca has already reduced its Delaware workforce by more than half. Chrysanthis says the companies are scrambling to build a more promising drug pipeline, as many of their big-selling drugs face generic competition.
Pfizer and AstraZeneca are less companies in the sense of sales than they were a few years ago. Why? As part of the challenges, a lot of patent expiration of top-name drugs.
For Pfizer, that's meant Lipitor. For AstraZeneca, Nexium, and a whole lot more. Looking ahead, AstraZeneca points to promising research in its cancer division. Gordon, with the University of Michigan, says with this Pfizer deal done for now, a lot more rests on AstraZeneca developing those drugs.
So they have the opportunity to stay independent, but there's a lot of pressure to perform and to perform at a higher level than AstraZeneca has performed at over the last 10 years.
For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
This disclosure, AstraZeneca is a sponsoring underwriter for The Pulse. Coming up, we head to the Franklin Institute to check out a brand new exhibit dedicated to the human brain.
So this is a room where you walk inside, you sit down, you feel like you're in a movie theater, and then the whole room starts to rotate around you.
That's next, right here on WHYY.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, filling in for Mike and Scott. There's a brand new building at Philadelphia's Franklin Institute, which achieves a long-standing goal. When the Science Museum was first conceived in the 1930s, it was supposed to take up a full city block. Just two sides were built then, a third came in 1990, and now a $41 million addition is complete, and it's anchored by what the Franklin Institute is calling the nation's largest permanent exhibit devoted to the human brain. It opens June 14th, but our Zach Seward got in a sneak peek.
The construction crews are putting on the finishing touches. The Franklin Institute's chief bioscientist, Jayatri Das, is showing us around the sprawling new exhibit. It's called Your Brain.
It's not the brain. It's not a human brain. It's your brain. And in this exhibit, you'll be learning about how your brain creates the world around you.
It's meta like that. The project has been in the works for 7 years.
This exhibit has been inside the heads of the exhibit team for so long that we're really excited for it to be a physical reality and really watch people use it.
The first thing they'll use is a giant movie screen. Das says it's one of 80 interactive installations meant to get you thinking about how you're thinking. Sensors pick up your silhouette as you move and project it on the screen, along with an image of a brain and a network of nerves, roughly where they are in real life.
And that way you immediately get a sense of the fact that, okay, I've got this brain in my head, it's connected to the nerves all through my body. Let's go figure out what this does for me.
The move from the digital to the tangible is quick. To your left, a real brain sits behind glass, smaller than you might think, because Das says your brain shrinks as you age. There are artistic representations of brains, visualizations of MRI scans of a brain at rest, a big globe of flashing reds and blues.
And we wanted to show this because there's this common misconception out there that we only use 10% of your brain, when in fact you use 100% of your brain every day.
You move through this room and into the heart of the brain exhibit, a trippy representation of a mind itself.
So now we're going to move into an area of the exhibit where we darken the space. You're walking through brain folds to make it feel like you're really about to dive deep into the brain.
There's a two-story tall climbing structure in this room. Its netted tunnels weave upward through flashes of colored light and pops of sound, some of which are from recordings of actual neurons.
As you walk through the space, there are sound effects that you trigger with your actions, and this whole space represents the activity that's always happening in your brain as signals are traveling back and forth and from one part to the other to underlie everything that you do.
When there's a lot of people in here, it must get pretty crazy.
It's awesome. I think it's the best representation of brain activity we could get is 50 kids running in and climbing through the space.
The study of the brain is having an extended moment, from PTSD in U.S. soldiers to the impact of concussions in the NFL all the way down to youth sports. Das hopes the new exhibit at the Franklin can inform that bigger dialogue.
We hope that our exhibit is really a launching point for those kinds of conversations right here in Philadelphia, because as people learn about the basic science in our exhibit, that allows us to build on that knowledge and talk about some of these bigger issues surrounding brain health.
That's not to say the exhibit isn't also meant to be fun. An entire stretch of the space is packed with optical illusions. The classics, two faces or a vase, sure, but also elaborately constructed rooms that thoroughly tilt your perspective. Optical illusions are fun, but they're also scientifically useful because they show how your brain prioritizes information.
And the moral of the story that your eyes always win.
But this is radio. So here, have an audio illusion.
So what you'll hear is a sentence, a spoken sentence, that's been transformed by a computer to sound like gibberish. So, any idea what they said?
No.
Okay. You can hear it one more time. Okay, now we'll hear the real sentence.
The Constitution Center is at the next stop.
Does it make sense that time?
Yeah, wait, was that the same?
It was the exact same sentence that you heard the first time.
No way.
It's the exact same sentence. Your brain is always using prior information to make sense of new information coming in. So once you know what the sentence is, when you go back and hear the distorted version, you can apply that information and it makes sense.
Do you have like a favorite brain factoid? You know a lot of stuff about brains. You spend a lot of time thinking about them. Do you have a favorite piece of information that you like to share about the brain?
Your brain is always changing. It's never the same from 1 minute to the next. By the time we've finished walking through this exhibit, your brain will be different from when you walked in.
There are interactives on language acquisition and how chemical signals link neurons, even an ethics section. Would you erase some of your memories if you could? But all in all, Das says she wants adults and kids alike to leave the new exhibit with a sense of how to nurture your brain and optimism about today's exciting new frontiers in brain research. For The Pulse, I'm Zach Seward.
And for three simple tips on how to maintain brain health from the Franklin Institute's J. Autry Das, check out our sidebar on this story at whyy.org/thepulse.
The only thing worse than bad memories is no memories at all.
It's all the rage in the food world. Gluten-free products, pizzas, cookies, breads, candies, even beer, prepared to cater to the person who is gluten sensitive. But is gluten sensitivity fact or fiction? Australian researcher Peter Gibson has conducted a study which seemingly contradicts his own earlier research, which found that gluten could cause gastrointestinal distress in some people. And the study, by the way, excludes people with celiac disease. So what does this all mean? Joining us is Dr. Stephanie Molesky, a gastroenterologist at Jefferson University. Welcome back to The Pulse.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So, Dr. Molesky, we've touched on gluten before on The Pulse. If you would, just give us a quick refresher on what gluten is.
So gluten is a protein. It's found in wheat, barley, and rye. It's of particular concern because in some patients, particularly patients with celiac disease, eating gluten will cause inflammation of their small bowel.
Let's distinguish between celiac and gluten sensitivity.
Celiac disease is a genetic disease with an environmental trigger of gluten. And patients who have celiac disease, when they eat gluten, they have inflammation of their small bowel. And that inflammation can cause malabsorption. It can cause other problems, extraintestinal manifestations, such as headaches, joint aches, thinning of the bones.
And sensitivity, gluten sensitivity, is not as serious.
Gluten sensitivity is different. It's been sort of put on the map by this Australian group, Dr. Gibson's group, where they did a study in 2011, and they looked at patients with gluten sensitivity. They excluded celiac disease, which is important to do first, and then they gave them trials of gluten and recorded their GI symptoms.
And so the gluten in people who are supposedly gluten sensitive caused what sort of symptoms?
So it caused a lot of gas, bloating, diarrhea, and fatigue.
And who wants that? But then Peter Gibson did a second study. Tell us about that.
That was a really nicely designed study, a small study, just 37 patients. And they provided all the food for this study. And what they did was they gave patients a diet that was low in FODMAPs, which is a diet that's low in highly fermentable short-chain carbohydrates. So apples, we always hear an apple a day keeps the doctor away, but apples are highly fermentable. They have a lot of fructose, pears, mangoes, beans, onions, broccoli, lactose, so a lot of dairy, ice cream, custard, things like that. And wheat. They gave them that for 2 weeks, and then they were given either high gluten, low gluten, or no gluten.
And they didn't know which group they were in, correct?
They didn't know. That was blinded.
Okay. So what was the result then? What did Mr. Gibson find?
So they found that the patients who were self-declared gluten sensitive did not have an increase in symptoms when they were given gluten.
So what does that mean?
One thought is that the patients who thought they might be gluten sensitive are really sensitive to FODMAPs because they did feel better on the low FODMAP diet.
So what is the advice then to somebody who thinks that who are suffering from these gastrointestinal symptoms?
So the most important thing is to first exclude celiac disease, because celiac disease is, you know, a chronic condition. It's a lifelong. The only treatment is a gluten-free diet. It's very serious. And if you start to restrict your diet before being tested for celiac disease, you can have a false negative.
So the first thing is go to your doctor.
First thing is go to your doctor.
Dr. Stephanie Molesky, thank you so much for joining us on The Pulse.
Thank you.
Dr. Stephanie Molesky is a gastroenterologist at Jefferson University Hospital. That's the sound of several hundred Philadelphians marching from Rittenhouse Square to Love Park last Saturday in protest of genetically modified food. The protest was organized by March Against Monsanto, which arranged similar marches in more than 400 cities around the world simultaneously. GMOs are at the center of a swirling debate about the safety of what we eat. There's been a strong push to label foods containing genetically modified ingredients, though a recent New York Times poll found that only half of those surveyed would actively try to avoid GMO foods. Guest commentator Rebecca Rupp has a dog in this fight. She's a blogger for National Geographic's The Plate, and here's her take.
We all know that there are topics to avoid at dinner parties. Politics, religion, and money, for example, can quickly turn a fun evening into a screaming match. Nowadays, another of these touchy subjects is GMOs, genetically modified organisms. Impassioned rhetoric between pro-GMO and anti-GMO camps brings to mind the Hatfields and the McCoys, especially when it relates to food. Well, from my side of the table, I'm here to say that GMOs aren't the Frankensteinian monsters that they've been accused of being. In fact, they soon may be crucial to feeding and curing the skyrocketing world population. Take, for example, golden rice, in which a couple of genes from daffodils and one from a bacterium have been added to the rice genome, allowing it to make beta-carotene, the stuff that makes carrots orange, a building block of vitamin A. Vitamin A deficiency worldwide causes over 1 million deaths a year and 500,000 cases of blindness. Golden rice is an easy dietary fix to this problem if we'd let it get off the ground. But to a lot of people, GMOs sound freaky. Unlike traditional hybrids, they're transgenic, cobbled together with genetic material from sometimes widely disparate organisms. Jellyfish genes in potatoes cause the plants to glow when thirsty, which helps conserve water. Rat genes boost the vitamin C content of lettuce by 700%. Fish genes make tomatoes resistant to cold. GM crops could eventually include fruits and vegetables that carry vaccines. We may be able to prevent cholera and hepatitis B, for example, simply by eating bananas. Others could carry genes that allow them to grow in poor soil or during droughts, or genes that fend off pests and diseases, as in the GM papayas now immune to the fatal ring spot virus that nearly destroyed Hawaii's papaya groves. This isn't to say that there aren't worries about GMOs, but all new technologies have potential dangers. GM crops, like everything from antibiotics to the cell phone, need oversight and testing. But the vast bulk of reputable evidence shows that GM food is safe and that GM crops are productive and able to grow in places where non-GM crops turn up their toes and die. I think it's important to remember that genetic modification is not solely the purview of giant corporations. There are concerned researchers out there who are trying to solve global problems. Right now, worldwide, over 800 million people are hungry, and by 2050, we're going to have 9 billion people to feed. GM crops can help. Let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater.
That's Rebecca Rupp. She blogs for National Geographic's The Plate and is the author of How Carrots Won the Trojan War on the Science and History of Garden Vegetables. Do you agree with her take on GMOs? Disagree? Let us know at thepulse@whyy.org. It's time now for our series, Patient Files, your stories of illness, healing, and coping. In this edition, Pastor Stephen Weiser tells us about beating the odds to survive a rare chronic disease and how dealing with his illness has given him special insight into the needs of his congregation.
Christ is alive, let Christians see.
I've been a pastor for about 26 years now. I have hemophilia. It's a lifelong chronic illness. It means my blood doesn't clot. It means one of the many blood factors that you need to get a clot is missing completely in my blood. Hemophilia is a sex-linked genetic disease, and so my grandfather had it. My mother was a carrier. I was born, and I started having these massive hemorrhages, and nobody knew why I was bleeding so much. I was close to death a couple of times and given transfusions of whole blood and eventually diagnosed with hemophilia. Hemophilia varies in degrees between mild and severe, and I have severe hemophilia. The largest risk is joint bleeding. Those are the big areas where you bleed, and when a joint bleeds, it fills with blood and it's very painful. Since my joints have a lot of damage, I can reach for something and go too far. And it can cause like a little adhesion to break. And if a little adhesion breaks, it'll bleed, and in a normal body, it would stop within 10 minutes. And for a person that has no clotting, it'll just keep bleeding until you take the clotting factor. It meant that I grew up wearing braces, being on crutches, using wheelchair, you know, having my arms in slings. And, you know, we're talking those old leather and metal braces that went into your shoe that squeaked when you walked. It meant that all of that was part of my life, and all of that had to fit into the life of a regular child that, you know, wanted to, you know, ride bikes and climb trees. And neither of which are actually helpful with hemophilia. The treatment for the disease has progressed a lot. There was just sort of a sense that, you know, you just got what came with the disease. And that's not the case today. People have a much better outlook. The idea that Christians have of God being with them in a bodily, wounded sense.
Jesus, the risen Savior, the wounded Savior with the scars on his hands and his feet.
Means a lot to a wounded person. And so that's a very strong metaphor for me. I'm a chaplain right now at the Paul's Run community. Paul's Run is a continuing care retirement community. And I had been here for about 2 weeks. Because I had been having a relatively healthy 2 weeks, there was nothing really visible. I limped a little bit, but around here, everybody limps. The day of this particular service, I happened to have a bleed in my arm, so I was wearing a sling. And so after 2 weeks, it was the first time that the residents had seen me physically wounded. We were in the chapel, and as elders were doing, they were all whispering. And how elders whisper, it's like, "What's wrong with the chaplain?" Really loudly. I stood there in the center with my sling, and I told the short story of my history with hemophilia, many of the things that I had been through. And I said to them, I said to the community, I don't know how long I'm going to be here as your chaplain, but I want you to know that as long as I am here, you have a chaplain who gets it. Someone who gets the woundedness, the wheelchairs, the walkers. And we don't have to start there with our conversations. We can go from there and talk about life and what that means.
That was Stephen Weiser talking about his experience living with hemophilia. Coming up on The Pulse, your chance to sign up for a suborbital spaceflight on Virgin Galactic's Spaceship Two.
It gets carried up into midair by a much larger mothership called White Knight 2. And then once it gets high in the atmosphere, about halfway, it just drops it in midair. And that's when Spaceship 2's rocket engines turn on and fire.
That's next on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Mike and Scott. Joining us now is Clara Moskowitz, an associate editor with Scientific American. She's here to talk about the commercial space race and space tourism. Clara, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So it seems some space travel will soon be available to the public?
That's right. One company, Virgin Galactic, is planning to fly their first passengers later this year. They have a spaceship called Spaceship Two, which is a suborbital vehicle. It doesn't make a full orbit around the Earth, but it kind of makes a giant arc into the sky. It all happens within a day, and you get about 5 minutes of weightlessness and a five-minute view of Earth from below, from the blackness of space.
So, Clara, what then is the typical experience like? You touched on it a bit, but do you strap in? How long does it take you to get to the, I guess, the suborbital area? Are you pinned back in your seat as the rockets are taking off?
Right. So it's all in a day's work for a suborbital trip. You strap in, you're wearing a spacesuit, but it's kind of minimal. It's not the big white or orange bulky thing you might be picturing on a NASA astronaut. And it takes about 2 hours to get up to space, more or less. And then, like I said, you have 5 or 10 minutes up there in space, and then another couple hours descent. And the ascent and the descent are going to have nice views as well.
Are they comfortable, the ascent and the descent? Or might you need an air sick bag?
You will definitely feel some extra G-forces, actually. I've been on a simulator on Earth that tries to give you the feeling of ascent and descent, and they can do that in a centrifuge by spinning you around and around. And it's pretty rough, I'll tell you. It's kind of exciting.
And how much will space tourists have to pony up?
So Virgin Galactic is selling tickets aboard its Spaceship Two vehicle for $250,000 each.
Wow.
And a competitor called X-Core has a Lynx spaceship that I believe is a bit cheaper, maybe around $100,000.
So this is a passion at this point for the very rich.
That's right. But the idea is once they get these things going and test out everything and scale it up, eventually, this could be a lot more reachable by people like you and me.
So let's take a look at fitness for a moment. It doesn't sound as if passengers are going to need to train as astronauts do, but it seems as if there's going to have to be some level of basic fitness.
I think that's true, and the industry is really struggling to decide just how much and just how much they're going to scrutinize their customers. So obviously, it's a lot less burdensome than traveling to space, and a lot wider range of people could probably handle this trip just fine. But like I said, you're going to experience some extra G-forces, meaning probably two or three times the weight of gravity on your chest pushing down into you. So if you have heart problems, it might not be a great idea. Probably training will be on the order of 3 days before your flight. You'll go down, you'll get in a simulator, you'll do blood pressure tests and other vitals, and they'll make sure you're fit. But it really remains to be seen.
So at this point, if the blood pressure works out and et cetera, somebody who's 80 and who's always wanted to do this might be able to get on board?
It's definitely possible.
Space travel, of course, is not without its risks. What are some of the risks that these companies are looking at this point?
Well, obviously, the big question is, you know, what happens when you have a major accident? Not just a risk like a minor injury, but death, which is certainly possible. Everybody admits that spaceflight is dangerous. It has always been dangerous. And even though it's scaling down to average people and these suborbital trips aren't quite as intense as orbit, sending anybody off the face of the Earth involves some major risks. So when we have our first major failure, and most people do say when, not if, it'll really be a test of the industry to see if they can communicate to people that this risk is just something we have to accept in order to push this frontier into space.
So you have the risk. You have the relatively short time looking at Earth from outer space, 5 to 10 minutes. And you've also got the expense. Is there a line of people waiting to do this despite all this?
There actually is. Yes, there's a wait list. Hundreds of people long. I believe Virgin Galactic has more than 500 people who have already signed up. You've got average people. You've got celebrities like Angelina and Jolie and Brad Pitt reportedly having paid for tickets. So there are many, many people who have dreamed of going to space. And this really is your best chance to do it.
So do these space vessels resemble NASA's space shuttle at all?
Not very much. In fact, Spaceship Two is a really neat design because itself, it's a mini space plane and it gets carried up into midair by a much larger mothership plane called White Knight Two. So you have to picture just a really gigantic airliner. And White Knight Two lifts Spaceship Two up from below it. And then once it gets high in the atmosphere, about, you know, halfway, it just drops it in midair. And that's when Spaceship Two's rocket engines turn on and fire from below it, and it boosts it the rest of the way up into space.
And one benefit of this commercial space race, if you will, is that unemployed astronauts or underemployed astronauts are finding work.
That's right. A lot of NASA astronauts have retired with the retirement of the space shuttle just because there's a lot less opportunity to be going up these days. And the number one place a lot of them look is the commercial industry, which is hiring right and left for experienced space travelers who have all the expertise they need in designing the next generation of vehicles to take people up into space.
Clara, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Clara Moskowitz is an associate editor with Scientific American. Every couple of months, public health workers from across Philly gather after work to drink red wine out of plastic cups and to talk shop for fun. This month's topic, zoonosis, or infections that can leap from animals to humans. Tanya English stopped in on this month's meeting to learn more.
The Public Health Nerd Club is reading Spillover. It's a book about animal infections and the next human pandemic. Infectious disease doctor Steve Gluckman was expecting a sensational story and shoddy research.
And on both counts, I was wrong.
These public health enthusiasts are very particular about getting the details right.
I was impressed with the writer's ability to explain science.
Jennifer Chapman started the group to share stories and strategies from the front lines, and she's hoping to raise the public profile of public health.
When public health works, Nobody knows what it is.
She says public health is the invisible, important stuff that lots of us take for granted. Seatbelts, clean water, sewers. This month, the group is talking about zoonosis. That's an infection that leaps from animals to people. Book author David Quammen writes that zoonotic viruses are like predators that eat their prey from within. Here's a passage.
Although infectious disease can seem grisly and dreadful, under ordinary conditions, it's every bit as natural as what lions do to wildebeests and zebras, or what owls do to mice. But conditions aren't always ordinary.
Over time, some viruses change, then move out of their home in a bat, or a mouse, or a chimpanzee. Pathogens can adapt and cause havoc in humans. Malaria, Lyme disease, Ebola, HIV. Infectious disease specialist Steve Gluckman says they're all zoonotic diseases.
The concern there is not just that they make a person sick, but do they have the ability to spread and make a lot of people sick?
A researcher from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, Carter Cowden, asks the question that's on everyone's mind.
What illness are you most worried about causing the next pandemic?
I don't know if I should say it first. Mine's flu.
Not the exotic, scary answer that you might expect, but it is the kind of practical answer that you get from public health people. They wonder about the next bug that's contagious enough and deadly enough to go global. Not to worry, but to be prepared.
Pennsylvania's state lab.
The latest zoonotic disease that's grabbed the attention of public health is MERS, a few days after the illness reached the United States. State officials held a conference call to talk about the science and tamp down the hype.
Well, welcome to today's media call-in with the Pennsylvania Medical Society, where we will discuss the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS.
Pennsylvania's physician general pleaded with doctors to not clog up the state testing laboratory with specimens from patients who may have fever or respiratory distress, but probably do not have MERS. Science writer David Quammen says doctors are gathering a travel history from patients first.
You know, have you just been in Saudi Arabia? Have you just been in a cave somewhere with bats? And if the answers to those sorts of questions start turning up yes, then alarm bells ring a little bit louder.
In his book Spillover, Quammen walks with disease detectives in the field as they track different zoonoses.
Where did it come from? What animal? Why now? Where is this thing lurking? Why did it spill into humans now? How far is it going to go?
When a new pathogen starts to make humans sick, it's the beginning of a mystery, and scientists try to answer those questions quickly.
It turned out that the SARS virus was pretty good at riding airplanes. Eventually, it infected about 8,000 people and killed about 800.
Another zoonosis, Ebola, was devastating, but not the next big one that public health experts worry about.
Ebola is the virus that people love to hate. They've heard about it. They've heard lurid things about this horrific virus that comes out of the Central African forest, living in some creature there. But it does not ride airplanes well.
To be a true threat as a global pandemic, a virus needs to be both deadly serious and highly contagious. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
It takes curiosity, commitment, and a lot of stubborn determination and personal experience to become really good at what you do. In our series, The Spark, people in the field of health and science tell us what ignited a passion for their chosen careers. Today, we follow oncologist Dr. Marissa Weiss, a doctor at Lankenau Medical Center, who's made a difference in the field of breast cancer care. She is founder of breastcancer.org.
I had been a practicing breast cancer doctor for over 20 years when I had my own diagnosis 4 years ago. Getting diagnosed yourself is a game changer. You're on the other side. You've been in the patient gown waiting for the doctor to come in. You're cold. You've got questions. You've got fears. Concerns. I had the same fears as the patients I take care of. I became the dual citizen, the doctor and the patient. And I have watched people try to understand this enormous amount of complex medical information, make sense of it, make decisions based on it, and put it into action right away to save their lives. And I can see how overwhelmed, anxious, and confused, even if you're lucky to have resources and a great education, you know, when you're overwhelmed, it all sounds like mumbo jumbo. You can't learn new things when you're anxious. You need help. So I started breastcancer.org 14 years ago to help women and men around the world confronted by breast cancer to give them the best medical information so they could protect their precious lives. I've always been interested in medicine and science. I'm from a scientific medical family and a family about public service. What's fascinating about being a doctor is that everybody I take care of is so unique, and that's what makes it really interesting and special. When it comes to breast cancer, it does stand out because breast cancer is by far and away the most common cancer to affect women. 29% of all cancers in women start in the breast, and it's happening at even younger ages while women are in the prime of their lives, you know, career, family, community, you know, faith, all kinds of, you know, big demands and that they have in their lives, blessings too, they're dealing with. So that's unique compared to other problems, is that it is the most common cancer. And, you know, one of the good reactions to a diagnosis is to say, darn, I got this problem. What can I do in the future? What can I change to be healthier beyond what the doctors are telling me? Because I know in my everyday life, I have choices to make. I've always struggled with my weight. And when I was diagnosed, I said, these games have got to end. I just got to drop it and like get it down. I'm very careful about what I eat. And I know that exercise ends up being the most effective tool that keeps you on track with weight management. One thing that drives me is the health of the next generation, because breast cancer is already much more common for this generation compared to the last one. And if we keep doing what we're doing and living the life that we're living and having the environmental exposures that we're getting, the next generation, which includes my three children and my patients' children, I mean, they will have more cancer at younger ages than we do. And I think it's time to put a stop to all this. We can make changes now that will help lower the risk for the next generation.
That was breast oncologist Marissa Weiss, founder of breastcancer.org. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Zach Seward, and Alana Gordon. Jeanette Woods and Elizabeth Perez-Luna produce segments in today's show. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joel Patterson, our associate producer, Megan Pinto is our executive producer, Chris Satullo is our vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey is our chief content officer. If you missed some of the show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for listening.